are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show is Suresh Raj, one of the most vocal proponents of diversity, inclusion, and equality. He was raised in Malaysia to Christian Muslim parents of Middle Eastern and Asian descent. He's openly gay and has lived in the UK and is based in New York. Raj serves as a senior counsel for Vision 7 International's diversity, inclusion, and equality efforts. Recognitions include being named to two prominent global lists, Financial Times and Yahoo Finance's top 100 ethnic minority executive leaders, as well as the top 100 LGBTQ plus executive leaders. He's a founding member of The Collective, a global mentor for Involve, the diversity and inclusion specialist, and is an inaugural member of McKinsey's The Alliance. Hi, Suresh. Welcome to the show today. I'd like you to start with a quick introduction about your personal and professional background.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity, Sudha. It's good to reconnect with you after so many years, and thank you for bringing me on board today. From a professional personal point of view, I am the Chief Business Development Officer of Vision 7 Blue Focus International, which is the biggest Chinese equivalent of a WPP or a Publicis or a Nomnicom. So I think they're number 7 in the world. So we're a fully integrated marketing group, everything from creative, social content, public relations, so on and so forth, so the whole gamut. And I head up business development across the group. So looking after a portfolio of companies and driving growth, which I genuinely love. And I've been in this role for quite a few years already. From the personal side of it, I actually come from Malaysia. I was originally born and brought up in Malaysia. And I then moved to the UK for about 20-something years and then have been in the US now for about 5 or 6 years. Specifically, more on the cultural side, I am an incredibly mixed individual ethnically. So my parents are both half mixes themselves. My mother is half Malay, half Arab. My dad is half Indian, half Palestinian Jew. And then added to that mix, I'm also a gay man. And so I think my move to the US really provide me a bit of a filter to understand what it means to be really diverse in a corporate sense as well as socially. But yeah, so that's a little bit about me professionally.
That's so many intersectionalities. From there, let's move to this question about identity. How has your identity defined your personal and your professional journey?
It's such an interesting question because if I'm being absolutely honest, I didn't actually have a sense of identity when I was particularly in the UK. Growing up in Malaysia, that sense of identity was quite poignant because I was also brought up in a Muslim Christian household. Being of mixed parentage in a country like Malaysia was also slightly frowned upon because there was mixed religious points of view. So we're being Christian and Muslim in a Muslim-dominant country was actually quite difficult. But that's all sort of peripheral. But I think what really affected my growing up in Malaysia was actually being gay. And it was culturally, ethnically, religiously taboo. So I couldn't quite identify myself. And I didn't understand the concept of being gay because I didn't see gay people on the street. It wasn't openly celebrated in any which way. So I felt weird, like I was an anomaly and there was something wrong with me. Like physically, mentally, emotionally wrong with me. But, you know, because I was still quite young, I never had a chance to really think about it or explore who I was as a gay man. And I moved to the UK in my early 20s to study. And after quite a few years, learned to actually really accept who I was. And I think it was about 8 years into my life in the UK that I finally accepted that I was gay and I wanted to be open about it. I wanted to live that life. Just be free about being gay. And that was the first time I actually understood a slight element of identity. okay, I'm a gay man at that point. There's lots of other elements to it in terms of trying to come out to the family, to friends, to colleagues, etc. But I dealt with that. I think the sense of identity really hit me when I moved to the US, and that was about 5-6 years ago. And I'm like in my early 40s already, and you're quite ingrained and set in who you are at your early 40s, right? And it was in this country that I actually realized the color of my skin was less valuable than the others around me, and particularly people who were fairer skin. Like, people who are fairer skin to be more valuable according to the way corporates work here, et cetera. From an economic point of view, from a political point of view, they earned more. They got better opportunities. They had access to more. And I was very confused. To get to a certain level, to earn a certain level of income, et cetera, it was about your ability to deliver. I.e. that's got no color of skin, but no labels. That's an ability. That's your mind, your heart, your spirit. I actually realized from a corporate environment, my identity mattered because it then pegged me at a certain level. So the outward identity, just the color of my skin, like everything had like a price tag on it, which is when I really started to push back because I realized, hold on, you ought to be measuring me on my ability to deliver, not for the fact that this is the package I came in. And that's when I really started to realize I have to press my identity because that is who I am. And in order to push the boundaries of actually getting equality on the table. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. I just identified by the sort of work I did and with the organizations, only when it came to that point where I was unable to open doors for myself, did I start thinking about how my identity may have played a role in it. And so I understand your point of view. And it's really poignant because it shouldn't be like that in 2020 in today's world at all. Why has the industry been unable to make progress on race as much as it has done on gender? What do you think are the big challenges to doing this?
And just to define, when you say industry, do you mean in the communications industry?
Yes, specifically? I mean the communications industry specifically.
So there was an interesting stat I saw about a few weeks ago about the gender balance in the communications industry. I think there are about 62%, 62 or 67%, forgive me, I can't remember the exact number.
Yeah, 67% in the UK.
So 67% of the communications industry is dominated by women, which is fantastic, right? The subject of gender is technically, just from a mathematical point of view, easier to deal with because there's a majority, right? And so the voices of the majority can be heard. Having said that, I looked at the PR Week Power Book for 2020, which was published earlier in this year. I think there were like 423 names on that list. The majority of those names was still white male, right? So despite it being a majority women-led industry, the majority of the powerful communication influences, leaders of communications, are actually men. For me, what really troubled me was when they broke it down to the ethnic minorities and when they calculated there was zero black males in any sort of influential position. Zero black males. And I think there were two black women. There were about three or four Asian women. And so the numbers just don't add up because we are a diverse society. You just walk outside on the street and that's all you need. That's all the proof you need. So for me, I think we've at least addressed the gender issue because it's a dominant female-led industry. But race, my goodness, it is such a sensitive subject and everybody shies away from it. They don't want to discuss it because they go, well, you know what? It's really uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, let's not hide away from the fact that Britain conquered and colonized about 170 plus out of 180 countries in the world, right? Tried to influence the local cultures. And so for me, when it comes back to, okay, let's address the racial issue, everybody shies away from it and going, why? Because it's too uncomfortable, a conversation. And that frustrates me. I think because it makes people so uncomfortable because it brings up history. History that people are probably really ashamed about. And when they have to reckon with the history, they have to correct that history. And that's too much of a jump for lots of people.
What do you think of legislation on targets? Will that help move the agenda?
Yeah, I've got two trains of thoughts on this because, look, I think it comes from a good place. We need to address the imbalance. on that level, legislation and policies have a place in helping drive the diversity agenda. However, the real fix is actually when people start to deal with the issue in a very honest, transparent, empathetic way that actually drives action. That's what's missing. Right. So if you have a policy, you know, you need to diversify your workforce and you need to hit certain quotas, you just bring the numbers in. You don't empower the people to actually succeed. So, and you know, it's not just about bringing the people in through the door, but how do you empower them in education, in school, so that they become the kind of workforce we need in the future and then move up to a leadership role so that when they're at the leadership role, they start to diversify the view and the look of the business. And I think for me, that is the biggest part is literally the action bit. That's what's lacking. So policies, legislations are good. They serve a purpose, but really it comes down to the business leaders to actually drive by action. They have to lead by example.
We've seen that for quite some time, there have been employee resource groups, LGBTQ, women's groups, and they become like social groups. They have no real power to make any change, and they have no power to really give resources to either groups that are underrepresented or don't have the power. So it doesn't make sense to just have a group and not empower it.
Yeah, honestly, employee resource groups tend to be like safe havens. So I can just go hang about people who look like me, feel like me, think of me, so I don't feel alone. Honestly, I'll never forget the story. I was talking to somebody, we were talking about diversity in one of my previous agencies. And it was a lovely black lady who was working on one of the floors. And she literally told this genuine human story. When she gets out of the lift, there's a very quick route to her desk, right? So she turns left, she walks to her desk, and that's it. But she always felt intimidated in that building because it was predominantly white. So she always chose to turn right and walk past two black employees just so she can see there's more like me. I don't feel alone. And, you know, and so she literally just walks that path, takes the longer path, just so she can feel that she isn't alone. She isn't alone in that environment. She isn't alone in that company. And she's not the only black person on that floor. And that was so overwhelming. You just want to feel like you belong.
Yeah.
And so for me, one of the things that frustrates me so much, honestly, is when people talk about their commitment to diversity and their commitment to equality is, oh, we're going to hire a chief diversity officer. And they'll hire someone of color and just go, yay, I've done it. I have fixed our diversity issue. And assumes that the chief diversity officer is A, the fix, and he's going to fix everything else in the business. And I'm so sorry, that couldn't be further away from the truth, because it isn't. It's not down to the person of color who's the chief diversity officer, often the most senior person of color in the business, right? So the issue is literally right at the board level. At the CEO level, at the CFO level, at the COO level, and the CMO level, those are the roles where if we start to see transformational change with diversity and equality at that level, that's when you see the business transformation permeate through every level. The CDO is the one who will go, okay, we'll start an ERG, we will get things going, and it's all peripheral. It's like, okay, we've created all these safe havens and people can feel like there's something that's in there for them. And it's not necessarily, it's not the fix, it's not the long-term fix. How do we get equality at the company decision level, the board level? You know, and that's right at the very top. Let's try to crack that glass ceiling for people of color right at the very top.
Absolutely. Nothing is going to move if we don't start at the top. It's just going to be a tick box. It's not for the first time that we're talking about race, right? This conversation has been on for decades. And I can imagine how tired a lot of people feel with these conversations.
And I think I was very vocal about this, you know, particularly when the Black Lives Matter movement happened here in the US. It's been happening for years, but it literally took to a storm when COVID-19 hit, because why? People were at home. They were literally engaged on every element of social media because people were no longer in offices. So they could actually connect with what was happening in the media agenda, in the news agenda. And that's when it literally proliferated. It literally spilled out onto the streets, and you felt the anger and the frustration of not the 6 months of COVID, but hundreds of years of suppression literally bubbled over. And that's when a whole raft of big PR agencies came out with these announcements. We're committed to diversifying our board. Agencies that have been around for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, right? We're committed. We're going to do this. Honestly, and I'm sorry, I'm so conscious I'm about to swear, and I'm going, this is a podcast, don't swear. And I'm going like, what the have you been doing all these years? Why is it now? Because A, it's on the media agenda and you want to look popular by saying you're going to do something to it. No, do it first. Do it, change your business, show us the business results on how much more empowered your people are because they're given the opportunity to be at equal seats and tables at your leadership level. 2 years from now, show us that business result. Then talk about it. Don't come out and do a big PR stunt showing that you're about to make these changes. The equality and the racial issue has not just suddenly sprung up. It's been around for decades.
So from there, I'll move to a question that I was going to ask later, but seems like a natural sort of flow. So in this post-COVID-19 world, purpose seems to have become a buzzword. What is the overlap between purpose, equity, inclusion?
Look, we're dealing with the new generation of consumers, target audiences. I've essentially helped raise my niece and nephew. So for me, they're like my son and daughter, and they're 18 and 20 years old. And I started helping my sister raise them, and they were 1 and 3. So I've grown up with these kids. Yeah. It's a whole new generation. I mean, they don't have a father figure. They don't have a dad. So I became dad in that way. And this is a whole new generation. So like my niece and nephew, for example, are vegan. And they're vegan because they're very conscious of the CO2 emissions in the world. It's about changing the environment. So they have chosen, because animal cruelty is one. The other thing is about CO2 emissions in the world, particularly from livestock. So they, at this age, they've been vegan for about 5-6 years.
Wow.
Because they're driving change. They want to see a very different world. My niece, who's 18 years old, has just become junior commissioner, the first ever junior commissioner for the city of York in Pennsylvania, because she was the one who led the Black Lives Matter movement. At the age of 17, she's just about to turn 18 in November. So at 17, they are marching the streets and actually driving change. So if I'm a brand and I'm trying to sell my products or sell an image or sell whatever it is, and I don't connect with the next generation of consumers and audiences who actually are driven by purpose, they have ethics they believe in. They are steadfast in what they believe. This is the upcoming generation who's going to take over the world. And if they believe in certain ethics and purpose and policies, et cetera, and a brand is so disconnected from them, that's the death of the brand. You can't just say, I believe in the environment, but act completely opposite. So if you believe in the environment, you care for the environment, what's your supply chain like? Where do you spend your money? How do you support communities affected by climate change? Patagonia is a fantastic example of a company that's actually doing right. So they put the money where their mouth is, and no company is perfect. The bigger the company is, the bigger the challenges in terms of supply chains, people, so on and so forth. So purpose is a wonderful buzzword. You either become a Patagonia and try to live up to those principles and ideals, or you literally slap it on a can and assume everybody's not intelligent enough to literally dig deep. You need to be able to live and breathe it from inside out, right from the leadership, and you have to lead by example, right through to everything you do in your business, supply chain, so on and so forth.
I guess the time for just sort of whitewashing and retrofitting purpose into your vision and mission is done. People are very intelligent and very smart. And it's incredible to hear about your niece.
Yeah, generation. I forgot one important point. There's a piece of research in I think it was Coldwell Banker, delivered this interesting piece of research that talked about the greatest transfer of wealth, as approximate number, I think, but it was in the trillions. The baby boomer generation is going to transfer the greatest amount of wealth in the history of mankind to the millennial audience in the next 15 to 20 years. And this amazing wealth that they've built up is literally going to transfer to a whole new generation that is driven by a very different purpose. When we think about the baby boomer generation, saving, capitalist, blah, 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 and the millennial generation and the generations that follow are very much driven by purpose. So suddenly you're going to see how that wealth is actually going to be spent. And if you are not a brand living by purpose, you're not living to the ethics that you believe in, and you're not living to the ethics that your consumer believes in, you will die out.
That's such an interesting piece of insight, because the younger generation, they spend in what they believe in. And so if brands are not conscious, I think it's a death knell for them.
This is an anecdote. I was in Florence 2 years ago. And every time I travel for work or for leisure, I always buy my niece and nephew something. You know, my niece was an age where she loved handbags. She absolutely loved handbags. And she had just become vegan at this point. And I was calling my sister and said, there's a cute little teenage girl's handbag. It's Italian leather, right? And I said, look, do you think she'd like the pink one or the blue one? And I took the pictures and I sent it. And my niece got on the phone. She goes, you know, Uncle Ajay, I love what you're doing and I really appreciate it. But if they don't have leather that's made out of pineapple skin, I don't actually want a handbag. And this is a teenager who's driven by the fact that she doesn't want pure leather because it's vegan or nothing at all. So for me, that's how real the society is.
I've just learned about vegan handbags, actually. How has COVID-19... fake news, how has it impacted communications and PR professionals?
Well, I think the biggest thing is deciphering what's truth and what isn't. And it's hard, right? So you have to fact check everything. And we live in a world where we are fed everything through our social channels, whether that's Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or whatever it is. That's the content we're consuming. And frankly, I think that's too much. My family are currently on a Facebook fasting period where literally nobody connects on Facebook. And it's actually some therapeutic. I think the biggest issue is deciphering what's true and what isn't, right? So it's not just, you know, the blues or the red states in the US, for example, because both sides are cooking up stories. So for me, I think COVID has made us question a lot. You know, accessibility to just doing things that you took for granted, like walking down the street, what's been cooked up as a political storm, what's true, what isn't. I think the biggest challenge is actually deciphering what's true, what isn't. And so I think the onus is actually on the receiver of the news to fact check everything before they actually make any decisions that impact their life or their own personal decisions.
So would you say ethics has become more important than before?
100%. That almost becomes like the guiding principle to what you believe is right or wrong. And I think that this is where the individual's own ethics really need to count for a lot. In the current society, what we are seeing is there's a rise of nationalism. It's actually given rise to the fact that there are voices on so many levels and from so many parts of communities. So when we think about, you know, racism has no place in the world anymore, there are groups of people who believe in racism and actually celebrate it. They are very openly racist and they are proud of it. And that's where the challenge is. And I had a really good, so I moderated a conversation with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who's the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, and a really good conversation with him. And one thing he picked about is when there is apathy, right? So it's not enough just to say you're not racist, but when you see something that's been racially motivated or that's impacted somebody of a certain race who's been denied opportunities, et cetera, and you do nothing about it, you are, in effect, racist because you've not stood up for what is right. And so for me, that's a thing that changes. So how do you actively stand up against that and become anti-racist? How do you create the action that changes the status quo? So for me, I think understanding what is truth versus fiction, fact versus fiction, also believing in those ethics that as an individual, as a human being, like, you know, we're not designed to treat others unequally or treat somebody else lower than we are, because we're all born human, we're all born equal. And for me, that is one of the things that really needs to start to bubble up a little bit more. There's a complete lack of humanity in society these days.
In light of all these things, what do you think are the traits of a good leader?
I love this question. I think, honestly, the number one thing of a really good leader, the individual needs to almost overflow with humanity. They need to overflow with humanity. They need to understand that people of all walks and lives belong together. Right? And how do you create an environment that allows people and empowers people to really be themselves holistically, wholeheartedly? You want people to come to work to feel like I can be who I am. And by being who I am, I'm going to be the best that I am. And everybody benefits from that. So I think a leader that's not just about revenue or keeping the status quo, but how do you build in a business that exists without people, right? So what is our role as people? It's about us coming together, collaborating, and a leader needs to be able to draw out the best of these people. So for me, I think the number one thing leadership, particularly in today's climate, is an overwhelming sense of humanity.
Amazing. That sounds like really good advice. What drives you every day, Suresh? Where do you find your purpose?
Well, the fact that we still have to have these conversations, honestly. So I'm an overachiever. I was an overachiever in school. I loved studying. I loved doing well. And that has always been like a constant fire in my engine. I always want to do well. My only barrier is me. It's my mindset, my heart, my well-being, etc. So for me, that's the constant engine from a work ethic point of view. But from everything else, by seeing the continuous lack of equality in society, in our corporate environments, is the one thing that almost is fuel to the fire. So if you imagine my fire being my work ethic, fuel to the fire is the fact of the complete lack of equality and equity. And for me, that just keeps me going. We talked about chief diversity officers a short while ago. I would love the day when that role doesn't exist, and I don't mean that in a negative way. The fact that we need to have a chief diversity officer means there is a lack of diversity in the business. Wouldn't it be great if that role never existed because there was such an amazing equal platform that anybody can be anybody and can come through the talent pipeline and strive for an amazing career that reaches right to the very top, which means there is opportunity for everybody of every spectrum. Sex, sexuality, gender, race, and ability. I'm hoping that, you know, the generation of my niece and nephew will be a very different world. And I'm hopeful. So for me, these are the two things. My work ethic is my constant engine and fire. And I think the lack of equality that I see in the world in every spectrum, in every environment, is the fuel that keeps me going.
Amazing ending to this conversation, Suresh. I think I'll take some inspiration from there. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Sudha.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.